There is nothing wrong with your radio. Do not attempt to change the station. We are controlling the transmission. We control the volume.
We can change the tone to a fuzzy bass,
or focus it to a tinny treble.
We can speed things up so fast you can hardly understand what's being said.
Or we can make things so slow you don't care.
We control the content. We can make it boring.
Mystery Playhouse.
Or moronic.
90.1.
We can even make it repetitive.
Mystery Playhouse.
Or moronic.
90.1.
We can even make it repetitive. It's our show. We can do anything we want because this is
Mystery Playhouse 90.1.
Good evening, and welcome to the Mystery Playhouse. I am the Count, your host of horror, huh? Come in. I was just going through my monthly budget. You know, I've been doing this thing for centuries, and yet I still continue to wind up in the red, huh? Sure. It's rough, let me tell you, but what do you expect when you have all your funds at the blood bank, huh? Luckily, there's enough investments to provide food, though. That's right. I have liquid assets, sure. If only I was a better fundraiser, like at that marathon I was in. You probably have heard of it. It was called Run for Your Life, huh? Sure. Yes, and if you think I ran fast, you should have seen the mortals I was chasing, sure. They beat me, all right, and you know what that means. I came in dead last. Yes. In fact, I was so unsuccessful, you could even say I was first place, huh? But that's what I get for waiting so long before deciding to wing it, huh? Rest assured, that's the last time I ever go jogging for the jugular, huh? Which brings us to tonight's super scary show, which is anything but run-of-the-mill. We're going to hear Inner Sanctum's Corridor of Doom and the classic escape tale, Three Skeleton Key. But first, it's X-1 presenting Appointment with Tomorrow So Scary!
Countdown to blast off. X-5, 4, 3, 2, X-1, fire. Transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future. Adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. Appointment in Tomorrow by Fritz Leiber. The first angry rays of the sun, which surprisingly enough still rose in the east at 24-hour intervals, pierced the lacy tops of Atlantic combers and touched thousands of sleeping Americans with unconscious fear because of the unpleasant similarity to the ray from World War III's thermonuclear weapons. This was America approaching the end of the 20th century. America of the mask fad for women and the neo-Cretan dress styles. America of your local radiation hospital, of the endless war and the loyalty detector. In his bedroom in the Thinkers Foundation, George Helmut slept.
Good calculus, to the nucleus, adding a quantum equal to the resultant of G sub 1 prime. Repeating, the quantum...
His educational sandman purred learnedly in his ear, droning tensor calculus through the night, filling the hours that used to hold man's formless fears and floating anxieties with the rigid form and anchored shapes of mathematics. Precisely at 8, the sidereal alarm went off.
My head. Oh, shower. 96.8, commence.
Under the soothing spray of the body temperature robo-shower, Helmut took a deep breath and cast his mind to the limits of the world and his knowledge. It was a somewhat shadowy vision, but he noted with the impartial approval, definitely less shadowy than yesterday morning.
Dry blast, commence.
Employing a rapid mental scanning technique, he cleared his memory chains of false associations, including those acquired while asleep. He felt the snap of clearing non-thalamic reasoning returning as the brain surged into clear, sharp control.
Off. Clothing. Color key 705.
He stepped into his clothing, the severe tunic, tights, and socksins of the modern businessman. He smiled. The next big move had come to him in his sleep, as many of his best decisions did, because he utilized the time-saving technique of somno thought, which could function at the same time as somno learning.
Attention, robo-locator. Category, rocket physicist. Classification, genius level. Time limit for search, 20 minutes. Commence. Take dictation. Dear fellow scientists, a project is contemplated that will have a crucial bearing on man's future in deep space. Ample non-military government funds are available. There was a time when professional men scoffed at the Thinkers Foundation. Then there was a time when the Thinkers perforce neglected the professional men. Now both times are past. I would like to consult you this afternoon, 3 o'clock, sharp, Thinkers Foundation, signed, George Helmut. End of dictation.
The president is waiting to see Maisie, sir. He has the general staff with him.
Martian beast to him. Tell him I'll be down in a few minutes.
As a primitive nuclear reactor, Maisie, the great electronic brain, loomed over the knot of hushed-voiced men. Its front was an orderly expanse of controls, indicators, telltales, and terminals, the upper ones reached by a chair on a boom. This was the machine with a million times as many synapses as the human brain, the machine that remembered by cutting delicate little notches on the rims of molecules. This was the machine that timid cyberneticists and stuffy professional scientists had said could not be built. Yet this was the machine that the Thinkers, with characteristic Yankee push, had built and named, with characteristic irreverence, Maisie.
Have you the question for the day, Mr. President?
Here, Mr. Helmut.
I see.
The question on the Pakistan crisis is a little touchy. I don't know.
If there is enough data to answer it, Maisie will do so.
Well, of course, I didn't mean to.
If you will excuse me, gentlemen, I will code the questions for Maisie. Oh? Section 5, question 4. Whom would that come from?
Number 4. Physics. Upperly and his research team.
I see. Thank you, Mr. President. While I'm coding the tape, there will be time to watch the takeoff of the Mars rocket.
What beautiful, beautiful. Oh, I've often wanted to go to New Mexico. As a matter of fact, I've always wanted to go right through to Mars.
Mr. President.
My chief of staff thinks the project should be under the Army instead of the Thinkers Foundation.
Mr. President, this is the way Maisie designed the project.
Oh, I know. That's what I told him. Still, I wish you people could bring back a few of those wise little devils from Mars. It would be a good thing for the party, the country.
It's quite unthinkable. The telepathic abilities of the Martians make them extremely sensitive. The conflicts of ordinary Earth minds would impinge on them psychotically. Only the thinkers can contact them because of the clear training and errorless memory chains. Perhaps someday, in the future... Ah, there goes the rocket.
Beautiful, beautiful.
I am ready to submit the question tapes to Maisie. Stand back, gentlemen.
Oh, sorry.
And now... All right, gentlemen. Maisie is thinking.
The question tape, like a New Year's streamer tossed out of a high window into the night, sped on its dark way along spinning rollers. Curling with an intricate aimlessness, it tantalized the silver fingers of 1,000 relays, saucily evaded the glances of 10,000 electric eyes, impishly darted down a narrow black alleyway of memory banks, and, reaching the center of the cube, suddenly emerged into a small room where a sweating fat man in shorts sat drinking beer.
Here it comes. Get off my lap, honey. I've got work to do.
Can it wait?
I said get.
Oh, you didn't have to do that.
When Maisie thinks, she thinks. Open up another beer.
Look, I'm not a robo-barmaid.
Honey, do what you're told or I'll ship you out where they'll work some of the upholstery off that frame, slopping radioactive mud.
You don't have to get nasty, Jan. Here's your beer.
Yeah, that's better.
It makes you fat.
I like to be fat. It makes our relationship more poignant. Pass me the questions and get over to your keyboard.
You're a greasy pig.
But such an attractive pig. Start taping. Why, that dirty...
What's the matter?
One of the questions. Does Maisie stand for Maelzel?
For what?
Maelzel.
Does it?
Look... You just keep sitting on your brains and let me do the thinking. Tape. Maisie does not stand for male cell. Maisie stands for amazing, humorously given the form of a girl's name.
Who is male cell?
Edgar Allan Poe.
Huh?
It's a story. Male cell's chess player. About an automaton that was supposed to play chess. Poe proved it had a man inside it.
And they want to know if Maisie... They're wrong. Maisie doesn't have a man inside it. Just a lump of conceited lard. Oh, you could hit me with that. Look at my dress.
Get me another glass of beer. I must have come from the physics section of the Research Institute. Opperly in that ape Farquhar. We'll look into that. All right, start taping. Question one. The midterm election vidicast should be spaced as follows.
Morton Opperly's living room was quite behind the times. Instead of reading tapes, there were books. And instead of a 4x6 TV screen, there was a Picasso, still faintly radioactive from being smuggled out of the Manhattan crater. Two physicists faced each other across the table. Old Mr. Opperly and young Mr. Farquhar.
About that Maelzel question, Willard. Why do you keep teasing the zoo animals?
Because the thinkers are charlatans who must be exposed. We know their Maisie is no more than a tea leaf reading fake. We've traced their Mars rockets, and we know they go into orbit 500 miles above Earth and stay there until it's time to come down with the latest miraculous Martian mental science.
But we've already exposed the thinkers very thoroughly. You know the good it did. Willard, the age we live in wants magicians. A scientist tells people the truth. When times are good, when the truth offers no threat, people don't mind. But when times are very, very bad, well, a magician tells people what they wish were true. that perpetual motion works, that colored lights can cure cancer, that a psychosis is no worse than a bad cold, and that they live forever. In good times, magicians are laughed at. They're the luxury of a spoiled, wealthy few. But in bad times, people sell their souls for magic cures and buy perpetual motion machines to power their war rockets.
Are we supposed to beg off from a job because it's difficult and dangerous?
In my day, Willard, I was one of the frightened men. Later, I was one of the angry men, and then one of the minds of despair. And now I'm convinced that all of my reactions were futile.
Exactly. You reacted. You didn't act. If you men who discovered atomic energy had only formed a secret league, if you'd only had the guts and foresight to use your tremendous bargaining power to...
Willard, we scientists weren't the stuff of which cloak and dagger men are made. Can you imagine Oppenheimer wearing a mask or old Einstein sneaking into the White House with a bomb in his briefcase? That's not the way power is seized. New ideas aren't useful to men bargaining for power. Only established facts or lies are.
What do you want to do? Surrender the world to charlatans without a struggle? The thinkers are vulnerable. Their power is based on a series of lies.
All power is. The greater the lie, the greater the power.
What's it based on? A few lucky guesses, some faith healing, some science hocus pocus.
The power of the thinkers isn't based on what they've got, but on what the world hasn't got. Peace, honor, a good conscience.
They've sent for me.
Who? Jan Tregaron?
No. George Helmut. I got the radiogram an hour ago. They know they'll have to produce a real nuclear rocket pretty soon, and they'll need our help.
I'm afraid, Willard.
You think it might be a trap? After the Malzell question, you think they might want to shut me up?
I'm not afraid for your life. I'm worried about other things they might do to you.
They'd better be worried about the things I'm going to do to them.
Peace to you, Willard Farquhar. You have entered the Thinkers Foundation. Please remain on the slideway.
I want to see George Helmut.
May we take your hat and coat?
What the...
Do not be alarmed. Invisible radiation that's slaughtering all the germs in your body, while more delicate emanations are producing a benign rearrangement of your emotions.
Claptrap. I can recognize a 14-cycle sonic note when I hear one. Where's Helmut?
This way, please.
Helmut, cut out all this swami stuff. Where are you?
I'm afraid Mr. Helmut won't be able to meet you, Mr. Farquhar. I'm Jan Tregaron. Perhaps you can have your conversation with me.
George Helmut waited in the conference room with two dozen empty chairs. He had prepared by 2 hours' rest with the somno teacher on full volume for this conference, having strengthened his mind by hard years of somno learning, memory straightening, and sensory training. He had assured himself of the executive power to control the technicians and direct their specialized abilities. Together, they would have built the true Mars rocket. But, unfortunately, no one came.
Report.
No word from the door, Master.
They can't all be late. Did you check?
The calls have been put through.
What response?
Dr. Burnside reports he received the second message just in time.
What second message?
The message calling off the meeting.
Did he read the text of the second message back?
Shall I play it back?
Never mind. How was it signed? The signature.
Signature, Mr. Jan Tregaron.
George Helmut dejectedly examined his organizational charts, and then tapping his stylo on the pad, he extended his mental aura, cleared his memory chains of error, accelerated his cerebral processes by the Haber-Gerson process he had practiced for so many years. Slowly, he could feel the tight, heart-squeezing disappointment ebb. He was in control again. Tregaron. He was the one to blame. Tregaron, who was so used to working by deception that he must be shown the light.
Well, Willard, how was your adventure among the magicians?
Well, they didn't hurt me.
You're sure? And are you as determined as ever to smash and expose the thinkers?
Of course. Only from now on I won't embarrass you by asking any male Zell questions. After this, I shall bore from within.
Now, where have I heard that phrase before? Do I understand that you are becoming a thinker, Willard?
Certainly. That's the only way to smash them. Out-trick all their trickeries. Organize a fifth column. Then strike.
The end justifying the means, of course.
Of course.
I wonder if becoming a thinker doesn't simply mean that you've decided to use lies and tricks as your chief method. Well, you're working with Helmuth?
Not Helmuth. Tregaron. I'm afraid that Helmuth's career as a thinker is going to have quite a setback.
Oh, well. Goodbye, Willard.
Tregaron, I want to talk to you.
Shall I leave?
No, please stay.
Jan?
Stay. You ought to enjoy this. George has that errorless memory channel.
Tregaron, you know why I'm here.
I don't know. I've been sadly remiss in my precognition and clairvoyance exercise. I've been too busy with other things, other people, other exercises. But I don't need Major to guess.
You just went ahead and canceled the conference without consulting me.
You called it without consulting me. Shouldn't do that sort of a thing, George.
I was absolutely sure of my ground, perfectly prepared. I visualized it. The rocket boosting up on chemical power. Then setting sail.
Sail? Sail? A nuclear reactor rocket. George, you're fabulous.
Yes, sail.
Thin streams of nuclear reflecting material and the rocket feeding Maison streams behind it. I conceived it all. Complete. Except for technical details.
George, you are a thinker. A real thinker.
I know.
Now look here, George. Every man should stick to his trade. Technology isn't ours.
You know as well as I do that we're going to have a nuclear spaceship and actually go to Mars someday.
Are we?
Yes. Just as we're going to have to build an actual Maisie. I helped you organize the thinkers. At least I was your first partner. Our basic idea was that the time had come to apply science to the life of man on a large scale. The only thing holding the world back from this was the ignorance and superstition of the average man and the stubbornness and lack of enterprise of the academic scientists. Their worship of facts, even when the facts were clearly dangerous.
Splendid. Splendid. Caddy, get me another beer.
I'm filing my nails. All right.
Everybody wanted the new world. The trips to Mars, the knowledge of the human brain. All they lacked was the nerve to take the first big step. And that was what we supplied.
Here's your beer.
There was no time for slow and careful plodding. We couldn't afford to check and double check. We couldn't wait for the grudging approval of the professionals. We had to use fake stunts, tricks, anything to get over the big point. Once that was done, mankind was headed down the new road. It was easy to just heal the breach with the professionals and to make good in actuality what had been made good in pretense.
Very good. The beer.
We built Maisie. We built the Mars rocket. We discovered the wisdom of the Martians. We sold the people on the science the professionals had been too high-toned to advertise or bring into the marketplace. But now that we'd succeeded, it's time to let accomplishment catch up with imagination, to implement fantasy with fact. You suppose I would have gone in with you if I hadn't known that someday we'd actually make what we claimed we had already made?
Oh, was that it?
John, the day's come.
And I'm the man. I've prepared myself.
Caddy, clear the decks.
All right. I know. You just want room to point that fat finger.
I wanted to stay.
All right. George, look, every revolutionary wants to see the big change take place in his lifetime. But time for the second step. George, the average man's exactly where he was 10 years ago when we took over. Except he's got a new god. More than ever, he thinks of Mars as a Hollywood paradise with wise men and yummy princesses, like Caddy here.
You think I'm yummy, really?
Shut up. Maisie is mama, magnified a million times. The professional scientists, they're more jealous and stuffy than ever. All they like to do is turn the clock back to a genteel dream world of square caps and quadrangles.
Bravo!
I said shut up. George, maybe in 10,000 years we'll be ready for the second big step. Meanwhile, the clever will rule the stupid. The realists will rule the dreamers. George, did you actually think you could have bossed those professionals? Nuclear scientists? Rocket physicists? Oh, now listen to me, boy. They'd have torn you to pieces in 20 minutes and glad of the chance. George, you baffle me. You know that Maisie and the Mars trips and all that are fakes, yet you believe in your somno learning and consciousness expansion and optimism pumping like a corn-fed yokel.
There is a place for the man who has the courage to dream.
Sure. In a straitjacket. Oh, George, you remind me of those men who used to put out those lurid little magazines with Caddy's grandmother on the cover in outer space in a stripped-down bathing suit.
My grandmother never...
I said shut up! That's what it is. Frustrated little men playing science god to generations of pimply high school chemistry students and gas station attendants, conning them into thinking they're in the know, sprinkling a few formulas to the garbage and playing Atom Smasher, and then being very solemn about the role of imagination in science. George, the trouble with you is they forgot to take your zap gun and space cadet decoder pin away from you when you turned 13.
That's your honest opinion?
It's more than that. George, get a hold of yourself and quit taking fantasy in the veins. That's an order.
Jan, the strange part of it is that I know as well as you do that Maisie and the Mars trips are fakes, but some things aren't. The human mind, Jan, is a tool that hasn't been perfected yet. There are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamed of in your philosophy, Horatio.
Who's Horatio?
I said shut up. This is the last full cackle, George. You've been fooling around with ESP, huh? Telepathy? Maybe a little hypnotism?
Maybe.
All right. Guess what I've got in my drawer? Extend your consciousness. Telepath it. Visualize it. Never mind. I'll save you the mental effort. It's a pistol, see? Now, let me tell you something. I've got a couple of boys waiting outside. They'll take you by jet to New Mexico. George, congratulations. You're leaving for Mars tomorrow.
Mars?
Yes. I've decided Mars to be the best place for you. We'll arrange it so that your trip is, say, 2 years long. Perhaps in that time, orbiting up there, you'll learn a little Martian wisdom. For example, the big liar must never fall for his own lie. Meanwhile, I've got a replacement for you. His name is Willard Farquhar.
But I sent for him to...
Yes. You see, I too believe in cooperation with the scientists, but by submersion. I'll offer them the hand of friendship with a big fat bribe in it. You know what the bribe is? The power to destroy me. That's what I'm offering. Join us. Learn our secrets. Bore from within. Bide your time before you strike. But while he's biding, I'll have him. And when he's ready to strike, he'll find it's not quite the time. Wait a little bit. Enjoy the power. Play with fat old Jan Tregaron like a cat. And by then, I'll have him.
You can't replace me, Jan.
Oh, you were a good man, George. When we needed catchy slogans, ray guns, plastic helmets, and fancy sweaters.
I warned you, Jan. Don't underestimate the mind, the human brain. Even Caddy here is a fascinating instrument. For example, I had a little talk with Caddy last week.
Very boring.
Ah, but useful. For when we were finished, her mind had something it didn't have before.
You always were educational, George.
Caddy, look at me. Look at me. Look at me. Now, put your hand on his arm. Now. Now, take his gun.
Caddy, are you crazy?
I've got his gun. What now?
You see, Jan, there is a place for the dreamer, the man who believes, who can use his mind. I'm going to get rid of you, Jan, because the man who dares to dream will rule. Caddy, look at me. Look at me. Point the gun at him. Look at me.
I can't anymore. It's too ridiculous. Jan, take your silly gun back. It's too heavy.
What? Caddy. Caddy, I command you. Look at me. Look at me.
The power of the mind. Hey, boys. Come in and get him.
I don't understand. Caddy. Caddy, look at me.
Oh, all right. I'll look at you. Poor Superman.
Countdown for blast off. X minus 5, 4, 3, 2. X minus 1. Fire.
Kids, wasn't that scary, huh? Sure. You know, there's an old saying that goes, thinking is far from knowing. And George is a case in point. After he gets sent up in that rocket, he'll be far from everything, huh? Sure. Especially Mizzy, that man-made machine with a man and maid inside it, huh? let me tell you, I could use a few of those myself. Sure, it would be great for when you don't feel like going out to eat, huh? let me tell you. Which sort of reminds me, did I ever tell you that one about the cheapskate that served TV dinners at his daughter's wedding? They say the reception was bad, huh? But really, that's enough of the canned humor. Let's go on to our next super scary story. It's Boris Karloff in the Inner Sanctum Mystery, Corridor Doom on Mystery Playhouse. So scary!
Inner Sanctum Mystery, starring Boris Karloff.
Your host. Welcome again through the squeaking door to another session of mystery, murder, and madness. Oh, excuse me if I don't get up, but I'm all worn out. Yes, I've had a hectic few days with an old friend who just blew into town. He's one of those earnest souls who insists on doing everything for himself. Consultations with the monument makers, the grave diggers, fittings with the coffin makers. Yes, quite a busy body. But then we only die once, you know. Our story is called The Corridor of Doom. It's an original radio play written by Robert Newman. And our star tonight is a man who gives even me the shakes. The famous star of stage, screen, and radio, Boris Karloff. Have you thought about death lately? Not the fact that it's inevitable, that it must come to all of us someday, but rather how it will come. Do you think of it as a sleep and a waking, of a sudden transition from one state of being to another, or to a state of non-being? John Clay was one of those people who never thought about it at all, until he found himself walking down that dim and endless passage which... But suppose we let Boris Karloff in the role of John Clay tell you about it himself. If your blood pressure will take it, put out the lights. and come on a little trip down the corridor of doom. When I woke up, I had no idea of where I was or how I'd gotten there. I was lying on a hard white bed in a clean white room. There was a dull pain in my abdomen. Touching it tentatively, I felt a bandage. So that was it. An operation. But for what? And where was I? At that moment, the door opened, and she came in. Good afternoon. Or is it evening?
Whichever you prefer. It doesn't matter.
My name's Clay. John Clay.
Yes.
And yours?
You can call me Nadar.
Exactly. Where am I? In what hospital?
It has no name.
What? But that's ridiculous. I'd like to speak to Dr. Rogers. If you'll get him for me, please.
There is no Dr. Rogers. At least, not here.
Then who operated on me? And for what? Listen, I'm not a well man. I've a very bad heart. Will you get someone who can talk to me?
If you wish. I'll call Dr. Stone.
A chill crept through my bones. It wasn't cold. It was fear. Unreasoning and abysmal fear. The door opened again, and there stood a heavy-set man, his hair flecked with gray, and with him, my son-in-law, Alex Bartlett. Alec, I can't tell you how glad I am to see you.
Hello, Father.
But why are you standing out there? Why don't you come in?
Oh, no. No, I shouldn't advise it, Mr. Clay.
And why not? And why? Oh, is it you who operated on me?
Yes. I'm Dr. Stone.
Why wasn't Dr. Rogers called in? He's taken care of me for years.
There wasn't time. It happened during the night. Acute appendicitis. And even as it was...
Even as it was? What? And why are you dressed that way, Alec? All in black.
Well, it's customary. After all, you are my father-in-law.
Of course I am, but... Now, look, Alec. You've got to stop being so mysterious. You know about my heart, what any sudden shock will do.
I don't think you need worry about that anymore, Mr. Clay. And as far as the mystery is concerned, this initial period of adjustment is always a little difficult.
Difficult? Do you realize what it's like? Lying here, helpless, completely isolated, as if I were all alone in the world, or... Isn't there someone I can talk to? Some of the other patients?
Not just yet. When the time comes, you'll meet them.
But... Look, Doctor, I can't stand much more of this. I can't. If I don't find someone who really cares about me, who'll treat me like a normal human being...
Easy, Mr.
I won't take it easy. I won't stay here another minute. I'm leaving right now.
Sorry, but I don't think we can permit...
Well, we'll see about that.
You're getting yourself all upset for no reason, Mr. Clay. Making it very difficult for the rest of us. Martin, you'd better let me have some of that bottle there. About 10 cc's.
The... Red medicine?
Yes.
I don't want any medicine. I won't take it.
Now, please, Mr. Clay.
I won't, I tell you. No, I don't want the... It's awful. Salty. It tastes like...
Yes. But I think you'll find that it will make things much easier for you. Very much easier.
You're doping me up. That's what you're doing. Putting me to sleep. I think that when I wake up, I'll forget about everything.
Yes, Mr. Clay. You'll forget about everything. Everything.
I was somewhere deep down under the earth. passageway, stone flagged and with stone walls, and I was walking slowly down it in my bare feet. I could feel the chill of the cold stones through the thick layer of dust. The passageway stretched ahead of me, endlessly. And suddenly, I noticed that there were doors set into the walls on either side, closed doors. And on each door there was a name. Abel. Abercrombie. Abington. Where was I? What was this place? What was behind those awful, ominously closed doors? Something seemed to be drawing me on down the terrible passageway. Addison, Agar, Alan. I could feel the cold creeping up my legs, higher and higher, my heart pounding faster and faster. And suddenly I knew where I was and where I was going, knew what was waiting for me there ahead of me down the passage. Exerting all my will, I turned, trying to go back. With a roaring in my ears, I was falling through the darkness. When I opened my eyes, I was in that cold, white room again, clutching the blankets with trembling hands.
How do you feel now, Mr. Clay?
You cried out, sir, as if...
Well, a dream. The most awful, horrible nightmare I ever had.
A dream? The doctor will be very interested. Would you care to tell me all about it?
Oh, I don't even want to think about it.
It was about your former life.
Former life?
Oh, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have said that. I meant... Here, where are you going?
Get my clothes to get out of here. I won't stay
but
here
you
another
can't
minute.
Go. You can't. Martin, help me.
Please, oh, let go of me. Let go. Don't you realize that if I do stay here, if I dream that dream again... Listen. I was in a passageway. An endless, eternal passageway like a corridor of doom. It stretched on and on to infinity with doors, closed doors on either side. And on each one of the doors in alphabetical order, there was a name. The name of all those who had died since the beginning of time. I was walking down that corridor on my bare feet and... Why? Why are you looking at me that way?
You mustn't talk about that. You mustn't, do you hear?
But you asked me.
You didn't dream that dream. You couldn't have. And you've got to get it out of your mind. We'll help you. We'll give you a massage. That should make you relax. The alcohol, Martin, right over there.
A massage? You think that'll help?
If it doesn't, we'll call Dr. Stone. Try something else. Martin.
I see. Now what? What are you staring at?
Your feet.
On the soles. Dust. Thick, gray dust. Dust. Like the dust in the passage, the corridor of doom. And that means it wasn't a dream. It means I was really there. Silence, not in my mind, but in the flesh. My heart.
clenched like an icy fist that I threw the blankets aside, started to get up.
Mr. Clay, what are you doing? Where are you going?
Let me go.
But you can't get up. You can't leave.
No, let me go.
Martin, quick, help me.
Please, Mr. Clay. For heaven's sake, let me go. Don't you realize what this means? If it wasn't a dream, and if I stay here, go down to that horrible place
again. We've got to make him quiet down. Some more of that medicine, Martin. Oh. Another 10 cc's.
Right. Oh, no, no more of that. It's here, Mr. Clay.
You must take it. You must. It will make you sleep. Sleep so soundly that you won't be able to go down there again.
No. All right. Give it to me.
Here. You stay here, Martin. I'll go get Dr. Stone and tell him.
Better, Mr. Clay? I don't know. Color. Dark red. Taste. It's like...
Yes, I know.
And it makes me sleepy. My eyes get heavy and... Have you been here for a long time, Martin?
No, not long.
What is it like outside of this room?
It's strange. Like no place else.
And the other patients, what are they like?
They're strange, too.
Listen, Martin. I'm a rich man. You're the only friend I've got here. You've got to help me.
Whether you're rich or poor doesn't matter. As for helping you, that's what I'm here for.
You've got to stay here. Watch me. Every minute. My heart. I don't think it'll stand. Was one of cold, numbing cold, creeping up my limbs. I reached for the blankets, couldn't find them. Then I opened my eyes, and I was there again, back there in that awful endless passage, that corridor of doom. The same stone wall, stone floor, covered with a thick layer of dust. The same doors with a name on each one, on both sides of me. But now... Now I was up to the bees. That one there, Barber, next with Babbitt, and then Backer. I tried to cry out, but I couldn't utter a sound. I tried to stop, check myself. My muscles didn't respond. Slowly, heavily, I continued walking on down that endless passage. Past Badger, Baffin, Bagley, past the bees and towards the sea. Towards a door with my name on it. My heart pulsed, pounding with terror. My breath rasped in my throat. Convulsively, I clutched at the wall, forced myself completely around. Then, as if I were fighting against a roaring gale, I drove myself back. One step I took, two, three, and I stumbled. I was falling again. Falling through darkness. Complete. Absolute. Unending. Even before I opened my eyes, I knew where I was. Back in my room, the sheets crumpled in my sweating hands. There for a moment. I knew that this was my last chance. Slipped out of bed, tiptoed to the door of the room, opened it a crack, and peered out a hospital corridor. And sitting at a desk halfway down it, the nurse. Could I slip past her? Then on a table next to the door, I saw the telephone. A telephone. Save me. Take me out of this place. Picking it up quietly, I dialed my daughter's number, Alec Bartlett's wife.
Hello?
Jane? Oh, thank you.
Hello?
Jane, it's your father. Listen, you've got to help me. You've got to come and get me. I'm at the hospital. Alec knows
hello?
Where...
Hello, is anyone there?
Yes, can't you hear me? Didn't you hear what I said? It's your father. And Jane! I'm up.
heard her, but she couldn't hear me. Something wrong with the phone, her phone. I've got to get hold of somebody, somebody, but who? Dr. Rogers? Oh, might be out. If they come in while I'm phoning. Oh, I know, of course.
Police headquarters, Ryan speaking.
Hello, police. This is John Clay of Riverside Road. I'm at the hospital. I don't know where.
Hello?
Can't you hear me, officer? For heaven's sake, listen. It's a matter of life and death. John Clay at a hospital. My son-in-law, Alec Bartlett, can tell you where.
Hello?
Officer, officer, listen. Don't hang up. Don't.
I'm not...
Officer, officer, hello. Anything the matter, Mr. Clay?
Dr. Stone, your telephone, there's something wrong with it.
No, Mr. Clay, there's nothing wrong. Not with the telephone.
But I tried to make two calls, two different numbers, and...
I know. You should have known.
Nurse, all of them...
Should have known what? Why couldn't they hear me when I could hear them? Why?
Yes, Dr. Stone?
Will you put Mr. Clay back into bed?
No.
I'm awfully sorry, sir. I only went out for a minute.
No.
Come on, Mr. Clay.
No,
please.
No, leave me alone. Please, Mr. let go. No.
No, you're struggling. You know that, don't you?
Yes. I know. Doctor, I won't have to go back down there again, will I? Down to the corridor?
That's not up to me. All right, nurse. I think we're ready for another dose. The final one.
Yes, doctor.
No, doctor. No, not that red medicine. Not again.
I'm sorry, but you've had a lot of time. All the time we can give you.
All right, Mr. Clay.
No, I won't take it. You know what it means, doctor. I go back down there again to the corridor. It'll be to the letter C. To the place where my name is.
If he won't take it by himself, perhaps you'd better help her, Martin.
Yes, sir.
No, here. No, no, right. No, Doc. Again, I knew where I was before I opened my eyes. I could feel the dust under my bare feet, and through the dust, the biting chill of the cold stone. I was there, back in the corridor, walking down its silent length past the blank, closed doors. For the names on the doors, now they were all C's. Cabot, Cadden, Cahoon. On I walked, the beating of my heart, the pounding of my pulse loud in my ears. On down the passage, no longer even trying to fight against what I knew was an insect. On past Cameron, Chelsea, Chiswick, and then, suddenly, terribly, one door. Door with my name on it, gaping, waiting for me. I tried to stop, to turn, but my legs carried me forward. I was but two doors away. I could see into it now, see that it contained nothing. Absolutely nothing, not even a coffin. Just stone walls and a flat stone slab. I was turning, step over the threshold. I made a last convulsive effort. Merciful heaven, help me. Help me.
All right, Martin. Pick him up.
Yes, sir.
Is it all over? Hello, Bartlett. In at the death, eh? I'll see if there's any pulse, of course, but I should think it is all over.
It is, Stone, but not the way you think.
What? Clay, he's not dead.
No thanks to you.
All right, get him up, both of you.
Here, Mr. Clay, let me help you.
All right, Martin, I'll be fine from now on.
But how?
Don't look so surprised, Alec. Mr. Martin is a detective. I hired him some time ago. You see, I had a feeling that something was wrong when that railing broke accidentally, and I took that bad fall. So I decided I... could investigate.
You can't prove it. You can't prove anything.
The first results of Martin's investigation showed me what bad financial shape you were in. And it was then that I realized that you had actually been trying to murder me to get hold of my money. So I faked that story of having a very bad heart.
You mean it?
I thought it would give you the idea of trying something more subtle and less dangerous. And it certainly did.
But you still can't prove anything, not a thing.
No, don't you worry about that. Don't forget. Come back here, Bartlett.
You'll never have a chance to prove it.
Come back, Bartlett.
Oh, you shot him, killed him.
Well, I couldn't have. I fired up in the air to get him to stop.
Come on.
I don't understand.
Yeah, got a mark on him. But he is dead. He was the one who had the bad heart. That's what gave me the idea of pretend. Good heavens, look.
At what?
This hallway was supposed to be the corridor of doom. When I reached the door with my name on it, I was supposed to die. Look. Look at the name on that door there. The one right next to him.
Bartlett. His name. So what?
Nothing, Martin. Nothing at all.
Got the idea for that little alphabetical graveyard. That's right, for me. Huh? You don't believe me? Then come on home with me tonight and I'll show you the one in the cellar of my house. What's more, I'll show you a door and a neat stone slab with your name on it. And now a word of advice. If you should wake up tonight with a sudden chill, find yourself walking barefoot down a dusty stone corridor with doors on both sides of it, don't get excited. Just insist on a doom with a view. Good night. Pleasant dreams.
Now that was scary, wasn't it, huh? Sure. And what a hospital. Like, I've heard of an outpatient basis, but that hospital's basis was to keep patients out of existence, huh? Sure. But old Boris, he bested them. No, really, he did. He refused to give in to his son's evil plans. Actually, he wasn't legally his son. He was more like his son Outlaw, huh? Sure, and with dark suns like that, who needs knights? Why, he didn't even have heart enough to halt the hospital. So instead, the horrible hospital helped halt his heart, huh? Sure. You know, they say it was the gunshot or the name on the door that scared him to death, but I don't believe it. I say it was something scarier. He must have seen the bill, sure. That does it every time. With your money, you must part so the doctors can part tea, huh? Sure, they like to cat around a lot, too. Like they say, when the cat scans away, it's nice to play. And how they do play. Why, once I went to a dance that they held for the nurses. They call it the cotton ball, huh? And talk about the circle of aggressive man-eaters. Why, they were all after the doctors. Why, they were more like nurse sharks, huh? Which is perfect for the doctors, let me tell you why. I once heard that a ship sank and the only survivor not eaten by sharks was a doctor. They say it was professional courtesy, huh? Sure. Why do you think they never wear colors anyway? Because they look great white, sure. And speaking of sharks, there's plenty of them in our next classic show. It's Escape with Three Skeleton Keys. So scary!
Tired of the everyday routine? Ever dream of a life of romantic adventure? Want to get away from it all?
We offer you Escape. Escape, designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure.
escape to a lonely lighthouse off the steaming jungle coast of French Guiana, and a nightmare world of terror and violence, as George Toudouze describes it in his hair-raising tale, Three Skeleton Key. Picture this place. A gray tapering cylinder, welded by iron rods and concrete to the key itself. A bare black rock, 150 feet long, maybe 40 wide. That's at low tide. At high tide, just the light, rising 110 feet straight up out of the ocean. And all about it, the churning water. Gray-green, scummed apple, warm as soup, and swarming with gigantic bat-like devilfish, great violet schools of Portuguese man-o-war, and, yes, sharks. The big ones, the 15-footers. And as if this wasn't enough, there was a hot, dank, rotten-smelling wind that came at us day and night off the jungle swamps of the mainland. A wind that smelled like death. Set in the base of the light was a watertight bronze door. And in you went. And up. Yes, up and up. And round and round. Past the tanks of oil and the coils of rope, cases of wicks, racks of lanterns, sacks of spuds, and cartons and cans, and up and up and up, round and round. Over the light storeroom was the food storeroom, and over the food storeroom was the bunk room where the three of us slept, and over the bunk room was the living and cooking room, and over the living and cooking room was the light. She was a beauty, balanced like a ballerina on the glistening steel axle of her rotary mechanism. At night, you'd lie there on the stone deck of the gallery with the light revolving smoothly and quietly over your head, easing her bright white eye 360 degrees around the horizon. You'd lie there watching to see that the feeders kept working, that everything ran right. And it wouldn't be bad. The other two fellows snoring in their sacks two levels down. You'd smoke your pipe to kill the stink of the wind. And it wouldn't be bad. About those other two, Louis and Auguste, what a pair. Louis, he was head man, was a big fellow from the Basque country. Black beard, little hard black eyes, and a pair of arms that, I tell you, those arms were as big around as my legs. Yes, head man he was, and what word he let go was law. Silent fellow, and although I spent my first 2 weeks trying to strike up a real conversation, the most I could ever get out of him was...
I took up this profession because I don't like people. They talk too much. It's quiet work, light tending. Let's keep it that way. You're getting to be as bad as August. I thought maybe for once they'd send me somebody...
That was Louis. And when he accused me of becoming like August, I quieted down. Because Auguste was the talkingest man I've ever met. The talkingest and the ugliest. He was hunchbacked, stood 4 feet high, had red hair and big blue eyes. It seems he'd been an actor in Paris.
In over 200 different productions, dear boy, at the Grand Guignol. Oh, but it was monstrous horrible, the way we used to scare the audience. I was hated. Yes, yes, they used to throw things and hiss and bare their teeth at me. Finally, it got too bad. I couldn't stand it any longer. I gave up the theater. My nerves, you understand. Yes, gave it up completely. I really did. I couldn't.
It all started one morning at 2:30. I was on watch, lying on the cool stone deck, pulling on my pipe, staring out at the blackness, the phosphorescent combers and the big yellow stars, when, out of the corner of my eye, I noticed something show up for a second, something the light had touched, far off. I waited for her to come around again, and when she did, there it was. A three-master, a big one, about a half mile off, and coming down out of the north-northwest, coming straight for us. You must understand, our light was where it was for a very good reason. Dangerous submerged reefs surrounded us and ships kept clear. But this one, this sailing vessel, was coming straight on. I went over to the gallery door and yelled down.
Louis! Louis!
I had the glasses out now. I couldn't read her name, but I could see her quite plainly. All sails set, the foam creaming away under her bow, her beautiful lines. A Dutch ship, I guessed her. Why didn't she turn? Every time it passed, our light hit her with the glare of day.
Ship? Where?
North-northwest. The light will touch her in a moment.
Well, can't she see us?
Look at her. She just keeps coming on.
The square heads.
What is it? What is it?
Watch. North-northwest.
Ah. I know. I know what it is.
What?
The Dutchman. The Flying Dutchman. We did a play about her. What a performance. You ghastly galleon. Hag-ridden, curse-driven. Must on.
Oh, shut up, will you? Yeah, she's laughing.
Yes.
A sloppy way to come about. She's derelict, that's it.
Derelict?
Abandoned. Crew left her for some reason or another. But instead of sinking, she's gone on, running before every wind.
She'll not run long. Not with these reefs to break her up.
A beautiful ship. Now, why would men leave a beautiful ship like that?
She didn't ram us, although we all expected it. But as we waited for the crash, she luffed again, caught some odd gust, and went about. We watched her the rest of those black hours, heeling and rocking, pushed and pulled by every stray wind, every freak current. Watched her until the dawn came, till the sea turned from black to pearly gray. And on she came again, heading for us. We all had our glasses trained on her now.
August, you can kill the light.
Right, Chief.
She doesn't look so good by daylight. Think she'll ground this time? I say, do you think she'll ground this time?
This is impossible. Absolutely impossible.
What?
Here, take my glasses. They're better than yours.
All right. What is it, your... I had to focus. And then my breath froze in my throat. The decks were swarming with a dark brown carpet that looked like a gigantic fungus, but undulating. And on the masts and yards, the guys and all, were hundreds, no thousands, no millions. I don't know. An inestimable number. A tremendous... rats.
See them?
Yes. I see them.
Now we know why she's derelict.
Yes, now we know.
What are you two doing? Here, give me a look.
Yes, give him the glasses. Take a good look, chatterbox. Give you something to talk about.
She's still heading for us.
Yes.
If she's going to turn, she'd better turn soon.
Suppose she doesn't.
You mean suppose she piles up on the quay?
It's low tide.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Well, where's all the conversation, August? Huh? Here, you want the glasses again? You want another look?
No! No!
She's still coming on.
Go away! Go away!
Turn, will you? Turn, I say! I pray you turn.
The rats. Look, on the water, like a carpet.
They're swimming.
Sure, they're swimming. Those are ship rats.
But they're swimming for the rocks.
The door below, it's open.
Well, come on.
And down we went, racing down the stone stairs, taking them three and four at a time. Scared? You bet we were scared.
August, you get the windows. Maybe they can climb. We don't know.
Right, Chief. But hurry, hurry.
Look, you see them?
No. Oh, yes, I do. Up at the other end of the rock.
Look at them.
Millions.
They smell us. Here they come. Oh, close the door.
I can't. It's stuck.
Here, let me.
No. Move, you.
Made it.
Holy, that was close.
What? One got in. Look, there.
Well, get him.
Watch it. He's... Kick him.
What a brute.
He was as big as a tomcat. Bigger. And his eyes were wild and red. His teeth long and sharp and yellow. He went for us. Starving, ravenous. And we fought him. Fought that one rat all over the room. It was... Oh, believe me, I don't exaggerate. It was like fighting a panther.
I got it.
We'd better get aloft.
Yeah.
As we ran up the winding staircase, we passed the tiny windows of the various levels, and at every one was a thick, wriggling, screaming curtain of brown fur. I was ahead of Louis, and I dreaded each successive level. Suppose they had found a way in.
Look at them! Oh, will you look at them?
It's a nightmare.
Will you look at them?
The air of the gallery was thick and fetid with the stink of them. The light was dim, brown, filtered through the crawling mass that swarmed over the glass, all about us. We couldn't see the sky. Nothing. Nothing but them. Their red eyes, their claws, their wriggling hairy snouts, and their teeth. The rats. They screamed and howled and threw themselves against the glass. They were starving. And we three... We stood very quietly. Oh, very, very quietly. In the center of the glass room. Under our beautiful light. And we waited.
What can we do? What can we do, Chief?
Take it easy. Take it easy.
I can't. I just can't.
Won't do any good to... It won't do any good to stand here and shake.
That's right.
Go away! Go away, do you hear me? Go away, the sisters!
They won't go away. Not until...
Finish it, Chief! Not until... What?
Not until they've been fed.
You can take just so much horror, and then you get used to it. And they were interesting to watch, you know. They couldn't understand the glass. They could see us, and they could rush at us. But that thin, invisible barrier held them off, stopped them. From time to time, we caught a glimpse of the rocks below. More rats down there. Swarming brown velvet in the bright tropical sunlight. And then the tide began to rise. If only it had drowned some of them.
Ship's rats don't drown.
No, sir. You can't drown one of them. They're all climbing up the tower.
This bunch around us is getting thicker.
Say, what's the time?
6:15.
You've got first watch, Sean.
All right.
Wake me at 10.
I will.
Come along, Argo.
It was getting dark. One side of the room was lit a soft, filtered red. Sunset through the rats. Oh, very pretty. I set the wicks, checked my fuel, and then lit the lamp. It caught them, lit them in their gigantic wriggling web of pale, hairless bellies, twitching red tails, bright eyes. And then I started the rotary motor. The light drove them mad. As she swung slowly and smoothly about, she blinded them in the fierce, stabbing bar of light, moving continually about, ever turning, ever touching, ever moving around and around. And they, twitching and shuddering, eyes flaming when they were struck by the light, the bright light moving. And behind, on the dark side of the room, so close, I dared not turn my back. But you can't help turning your back when you're in a room made of glass. On the dark side of the room, you couldn't see them, but only their eyes. Thousands of points of blank red light, blinking and twinkling like the stars of hell. Louis relieved me at 10, but I didn't get much sleep that night. And when I came up into the gallery early the next morning, there stood Auguste, his back to me. He was bowing to the rats, waving his arms and making a speech.
Dear audience, I am going to play once again that magnificent role which made me the toast of the Paris Theater. Prelati, the evil genius of the medieval underworld. I am he who did guide the dark soul of Marischal into the nether.
I stood staring at him, horror-struck. But he didn't notice me. The man had gone mad. He kept turning, telling his stories to all the rats, leaving no one out.
August!
Another one, a late comer. Take a seat on the aisle, dear patron.
Stop it.
Giverey, the blood-stained monster, was my partner in iniquity.
He went on, bowing and scraping to the rats. His big blue eyes rolling and winking. His wild red hair waving about him. I grabbed him by the arms and smacked his face. He looked at me like a child. And then his face screwed up. He looked as though he were about to cry.
Go below. Go on.
Oh, very well, then. Later, my dear audience, later. Matinee today.
Sure, he was crazy. But I guess we all were. A few hours later, he came back up and caught Louis and me teasing the rats. Yes, sounds horrible. It was fun. We would get right up against the glass and make faces at them. It drove them crazy. They would scratch away, trying to get at our eyes. Louis was even cuter about it. He'd pull a piece of bread out of his pocket and press it against the glass. The rats would scramble into a solid ball, biting each other, clustering like grapes. From time to time, a whole knot of them would slip and fall 110 feet to the surf below.
Look at the sharks.
They're eating them.
Those sharks are our friends. Here, I'll get another bunch together. Here, my beauties. That's it. Pile up. Kill each other, huh? There they go.
Auguste joined in, too. Very ingenious, Auguste. He learned that if he spread eagled himself against the glass, they'd bunch and bundle against his figure. Then he'd leap back.
Look! My portrait in rags!
It went on all day. And then I was lying in bed. It was about midnight. I was very tired, and I was just beginning to fall off to sleep when I became conscious of a new sound. I couldn't figure it at first. I got up, lit the lamp, and went to the window. Even as I looked out, I saw one of the panes begin to sag in. They had eaten the wood away.
Louis, come quick!
What? What is it?
They found a way in!
I held the glass with my hand. Now they were all going crazy, and assured of the success of this maneuver, were all nibbling away at the wood. Louis ran below and then returned with a large sheet of tin. We spread it against the window and hammered it into place. Even as we did so, we felt the heavy bodies thudding against the other side as the window gave way.
There!
That ought to hold. If it doesn't, we're done for.
Rats can't eat tin.
No, they can't. But what was that?
I don't know.
Came from below.
The storeroom window.
They're in. They're swarming up the stairs.
Drop the trap, right?
There! Two of them got in.
Let's go after them.
We didn't have to go after them. They came at us. I leaped to one side and grabbed a marlin spike, swung, and smashed one in midair.
No!
I whirled to see Louis with the other. It had ripped his hand open and the blood was pouring out. He held his hand aloft and kicked at the snarling rat. I stepped and swung and got him.
Oh, my hands! He got my hands!
That's both of them, Louis. I'll get you something to tie that up.
Blood! Look at it, my blood, I'm bleeding!
Don't worry about it, Louis. Here! I'll wind this kerchief around it. It'll be okay.
Blood.
There! There, that's not bad. Just the flesh. And then I became conscious of a new sound. They were gnawing their way through the wooden trap door. I watched the wood, fascinated. And even as I did, it began to give way. And a bristling, whiskery nose showed through.
Louis! We've got to go up!
The next level was the living quarters and kitchen. I slammed the trap there, but it too was wood.
Oh, my blood. What are we going to do?
I don't know. They'll be through this one in a minute.
To the gallery. The trap door in the gallery is metal.
Good. Come on. We made it. We lay across the trap door, exhausted, while below us the rats took over the entire tower. I could hear them howling and fighting over our food supply, our water, our leather. And all about us, the others screamed and glared in at us, swayed in a tangled mass, hypnotized by the ever-turning light. By morning, the air in the little room was horrible. Until now, we'd been getting air from the tower below. Now that was sealed off. And so was all our food and water. We lay exhausted, panting, waiting, waiting. And the hours crawled on. I was almost dozing from fatigue when I saw a sight that brought me too fast.
Would you like to come in, my beauties? Would you? I hold the powers of life and death, and I can let you in, you know.
Auguste was standing by the glass, and in one hand he held a big wrench. He was tapping the glass gently, not quite hard enough to break it. I eased myself to my feet, and slowly, very slowly, tiptoed toward him.
All I have to do is tap just a little harder, and...
I found a coil of wire in the toolkit, and I trussed him up, fastened him to a stanchion in the center of the room. Louis was of no help. He lay on his side, looking at his bloody hand, weak and sick as a baby. So there I was, a lunatic and a coward for company. And all about, watching our little drama, the rats. The day dragged by. The supply boat wasn't due for another 12 days. I don't know what they could have done if they had come. And we had only one way of summoning them. That was to shoot off distress rockets. But the rockets were four floors below. And even if they'd been right there in the gallery, I couldn't have opened a window to fire them. That night, I tended the light, but its flame was devouring our oxygen. The following day, we lay thirst-tormented, starving, waiting. And the following night, I again tended the light. But the small supply of spare wicking we kept in the gallery had become exhausted. And quite suddenly, at about midnight, the light went out. There was nothing I could do. Wicks were stored three levels below. Nothing I could do. Nothing. From time to time, I'd strike a match to see the clock. And when I did, it lit up the million red eyes about us. All about. Watching. Waiting. Below, it had grown quiet. They'd cleaned us out, and now they, too, were waiting. All waiting. And then, the rats, quite suddenly, were silent. And then I heard it. Then I saw the sky and the stars. The rats were gone. I went to the glass. Out there on the water, a small freighter, a banana boat, showing a few lights, came softly and innocently towards us. Our light was out. They didn't know. I wanted to open the windows, to call out to them, to warn them somehow. But I was afraid. What if the rats were hiding from me, tricking me? So I waited. She grounded very softly on a reef not 200 yards from the quay. Grounded so gently that the man playing the cornet, was he a passenger, crewman, off watch? Didn't even stop playing. They tried washing her back off. I could have told them to save their fuel. The tide was rising, would have floated her free. And I waited. The story. The sun came up, and there wasn't a rat on the whole quay. Every last one of that terrible army had left us, gone back to sea on their new ship. August, insane asylum. He never recovered. And Louis? They took him into Cayenne, where he died of blood poisoning from his bite. Yes, that's the whole of it. And if you'll excuse me now, I must go set my traps. No, mouse traps. No rats in this lighthouse. I should say not. Life in the lights isn't bad. But sometimes, when I see a strange vessel approaching, I get a little nervous. Sure. Somewhere on the seas, there's a little banana boat without a crew. That is, without a human crew.
Escape is produced and directed by William N. Robeson. Tonight we have presented Three Skeleton Key by George Todus. Goodbye then until the same time next week when once again we offer you Escape.
Escape has come to you through the worldwide facilities of the United States Armed Forces Radio and Television Service.
Now that was scary. In fact, I'm shivering in my boots. How about you? I would think so. For a while there, I thought there were bats and rats in the belfry, huh? Oh, especially with that Auguste, let me tell you. When Auguste went down below, I knew he would return insane. You can call it ESP, but I just had a hunch he'd be back. Hunchback, sure. But what do you expect? I mean, his boss was always on the case, but I say it's better to be chewed out by the boss than the rats, huh? Sure. If the rats had it their way, that lighthouse would have had a real skeleton crew, huh? Then Auguste could have really boned up on his theater, huh? He could have done all the great pirate stories, just think of it. He'd certainly have enough skull and crossbones, huh? Oh, but seriously, kids, I've got to fly. So until next week, same rat time, same rat station, this is Account saying, if ever you go to a lighthouse, don't let them take your picture. At least if you do, don't say cheese, sure.
No, no.